Greetings, everyone. Welcome. My name is Andy Neal, and you're listening to the Hiker Podcast. Greetings, everyone. Welcome to the podcast that gets to know the hiker behind the trekking poles, the podcast that asks the why questions of hiking, the podcast that takes me, Andy Neal, a relatively new hiker, and asks hikers from around the world, how has hiking changed them, and how are you changing the world around you? The podcast that believes that hiking is for everyone and everybody. The podcast that wants to give you information and knowledge so you can be a better hiker, whether it's a mile or it's the Triple Crown. It doesn't matter. Hiking is for everyone. It does amazing things. That's right, you're listening to the Hiker Podcast. The Hiker Podcast is sponsored by CS Instant Coffee and Canuck Outdoors. If you need some instant coffee for the trail, might I suggest CS Instant Coffee? It is the best instant coffee on the trail. Go to the link in the description of this episode or go to hikerpodcast.com for all the information about CS Instant Coffee. They have been amazing to me. I can't wait to get backpacking so I can have some more CS Instant Coffee because I've already drank all my CS Instant Coffee. I need to get some more. I've been drinking it as my regular coffee. It's that good. Also, Canuck Outdoors, makers of the carbon fiber cork trekking poles. If you can get yours today, you can get yours today. You can get your trekking poles today, or you can order them today with 10% off by using the promo code HikerPodcast when you check out. Also, use the link. It helps me out. Helps the show out so much when you do that. I know it's a lot of intros. I know people don't like all the intro stuff, but you know, these organizations, these companies have been so cool to me. Also, you know who else has been cool to me? The Patreon patrons who support this show. Get the podcast pre-roll free in 24 hours, if not sooner, than the general public by subscribing to the Patreon as well as other rewards. Go to the description of this episode or go to hikerpodcast.com for all the information on that. And this week, I am super excited to have Shamise Kramer on the show. She is the public affairs specialist for the Rogue River Siskiyou National Forest. We talk about a lot, and this is an episode full of amazing information. We talk for almost an hour, and whether you are a new hiker, and this is information you've never heard of, things like leave no trace and know before you go, or you're a seasoned hiker and you just need reminders and the conversation gets your mind going, yeah, I haven't been doing it that well, or oh, I need to start doing that again. We just have an amazing conversation about the national forests and what to do as a hiker in the national forest and how to help preserve them and some of the challenges there are in a national forest and just all the things you can do to make your experience and others' experience the best as you hike and trek and camp in the beautiful public lands we have here in the United States, if you're listening in the United States. But all these principles apply all over the world. So we do talk a lot about our local national forests because we're both from Southern Oregon, but this applies whether you're on the East Coast, West Coast, and so many of the principles apply universally around the world. So without any further ado, my conversation with public affairs specialist of the Rogue River Siskiyou National Forest, Shamise Kramer. I know so many people getting into the outdoors in the midst of the pandemic, and so many listeners, people want to know, what do we do when we're in the wilderness? If you're used to living in the city, if you're used to not being in the outdoors, you might not know what is a national forest and what's the difference between a national forest and a national park or a national monument. And there's all these things that we've heard terms like leave no trace. Well, I'm super excited to have Shamise Kramer on the show. Shamise is the public affairs specialist for the Rogue River Siskiyou National Forest here where I live in Southern Oregon. Shamise, thank you so much for coming on. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me.
So before we get into it, just introduce yourself. Tell us your story, how you got into the position you're in, how you fell in love with the outdoors and public lands. Just, if someone who's really outdoorsy wants to know your story, what would you tell them?
So I grew up in Klamath County in a very small town called Chiloquin. And I grew up on 11 acres. I was within walking distance to the Sprague River. I had incredible amounts of outdoor space to roam freely as a kid. And so the idea of being outdoors all the time was not something unusual for me or for my friends. That's just how we grew up. And my mom actually worked for the Forest Service. The Fremont Wainema National Forest kind of surrounded our property on all sides. And I never really thought much about what that meant, what public lands were, what the Forest Service was. To be quite honest, I didn't really understand or even really care until I was an adult. That being said, being outdoors was always valuable to me. But the idea of going for a hike or going camping, that wasn't really in our lexicon. It was just being, right? That's just what we did. And when I graduated high school, I decided to move over to Ashland to go to Southern Oregon University. And I had spent a lot of time here as a kid because my dad lived here. But I decided to come and go to college. And even through college, I would go and I would hike on the trails in the watershed before they were really formalized. And we would go play outside and do all these things, hike Table Rock, hike Pilot Rock. And even at that point, the notion of setting out for a hike or to purposely be outdoors didn't really dawn on me as being something that might be unusual for people. When I graduated with my art degree, I felt like I needed to do more. I felt like there was still some itch that needed to be scratched. And so I went back to school to become a botanist, which ironically is what my mom was through her entire federal career. She was a botanist for the Fremont Wainema National Forest. And I am named after a plant. And yet somehow the idea of botany had never really dawned on me. But I was at Humboldt State and I decided to start studying plants. And I just fell in love with this idea of being able to look closer at things and to really see the world around me at this different level and to understand our interrelationship with all of those things and how they affect us and we affect them. And I got my start in working for federal agencies and public lands in 2003. It was the summer after the Biscuit Fire, and I was hired to work for the Siskiyou National Forest. It was before the two forests combined. So I worked for Siskiyou National Forest for the summer on a noxious weed removal crew. And when I say crew, it was a crew of two. It was me. It was me and one other woman who had been doing it for decades. And she knew every road and every weed population. It was like the map of the forest was in her head. And I spent all summer in 90 to 100 degree temperatures pulling knapweed and scotch broom and star thistle. And it was hard and laborious and miserable, and I loved it. And and you know, with seasonal jobs with the Forest Service or with other agencies, they only last so long, and then you're laid off because they're only funded to last so long. And when that job was over, I kind of had this idea that perhaps that's what I wanted to do, was to be a steward for public lands. And not too long after that, I was hired by the Medford District Bureau of Land Management to do more work following fires. There were a bunch of fires in 2002, I'm sorry. And so there was a lot of studying of the restoration work and what agencies did following those fires to get the landscape back to some sort of quote unquote normal. So I was hired by the BLM to go out and look at some of these other fires and do a whole bunch of data collection. And my job generally just started to morph from there, the whole trajectory of what I did. I wound up moving from that into botany full time. I would go out and I would survey landscapes and I would take note of what I saw and I would write reports. And I would basically say, you know, whatever whatever was going to happen, whether it was a timber sale or fuels reduction or trail building or any number of things, I would say how those things would affect the plants on the landscape. And one thing led to another. I went from botany into environmental planning and finally decided to switch back to the Forest Service. And so I moved back to the Rogue River Siskiyou National Forest in 2015 into public affairs, where my job, generally speaking, is I talk to the public about public lands and why they're important to them and their concerns. And frankly, sometimes they're really upset, sometimes they're really happy. And I, in my job, have to lean into all of those feelings. I talk with kids. I talk with other forests and other agency partners. So my job trajectory for all 17 years of it has been very amorphous. And through all of it, the most important part is being outside and experiencing those places.
So you grew up around public lands and the Fremont Wenyuan National Forest. You've worked in there approaching on two decades now. When you're not working, what do you do to recreate in the outdoors? Or do you just like, I've had enough outdoors. Outdoors is work now. I'm going to go watch Netflix.
Oh my gosh, no way. I mean, we do all the things in our house, including watching Netflix, of course. But we are a family of hikers and mountain bikers and road cyclists and cross-country skiers and just being outdoors when we can. And sometimes it's really hard. You know, I watched your video that went viral the other day, and that's no lie, right? Like that is true. Some Very days true. It's just not what you want to do. But I have also realized there are those periods where I don't get outside as much and I find myself just not as satisfied with the day to day. And I think the other thing that we've all learned through the pandemic is that being outdoors doesn't mean you have to go that far, right? It can be literally going around your neighborhood and just looking closely and breathing deeply. And so we, in my spare time, I do all of those things. And sometimes they're harder and sometimes they're easier, but I love them all.
And that's what's amazing about living in Oregon and Southern Oregon. I mean, that video, that viral video I did, I literally just, my daughter goes to a charter school. I had dropped her off and I have to drive by that spot along the Rogue River every day. And I just stop there to honestly use the pit toilet right there. And yep. I was like, I'm going to make this video real quick. And I edited it in my car at the trailhead, posted it, thought nothing of it, drove back into town. And next thing I know, I'm like, oh, this is getting serious. And that's all over Southern Oregon. And it doesn't matter where you live. I know there are places around New York City, public lands around New York City, that you can enjoy hiking and the outdoors. And in Los Angeles and Portland, especially, the outdoors is the outdoors. I remember growing up in Southern California, we had the public beaches, never think about it that as that being in the outdoors, but we would enjoy the state beaches and it's just beautiful. And the outdoors, you can find it wherever you are. And we're particularly lucky here where you can go climbing, rafting, through hiking, backpacking, fishing, all the amazing things you can do here. With all that said, we have a lot of new listeners, obviously, right now, and a lot of new hikers and new outdoors persons who like to listen to the show. There may be a lot of confusion about what is a national forest. I know here in Southern Oregon, I live near Crater Lake Highway, which is Crater Lake, you know, National Park. And then there's this Cascade Siskiyou National Monument. And then there's a Rogue River Siskiyou National Forest. And then there's the BLM. There's the Forest Service. There's all these different organizations that steward and take care of public land. Just generally, what is a national forest and why are they important?
I'm so glad you asked. I spend a lot of time in my position now talking to people to help them understand that while public land is all valuable, the agencies who manage those lands are very different and their missions sometimes crisscross, sometimes they're very different. So, The Forest Service was actually, it's a pretty old agency. Through a whole series of other congressional and presidential decisions, the Forest Service came into being in 1905, really. Like, that's really when it became the U.S. Forest Service. There had been lands that were managed by the Forest Service, soon to be Forest Service agency, but it really became the Forest Service in 1905 when Teddy Roosevelt transferred the care of those lands to what he decided to call the Forest Service. And he put a man named Gifford Pinchot in charge of leading that new agency as its chief. And so you'll often hear Forest Service people talk about Gifford Pinchot as the father of the Forest Service. National forests are very, very prolific and numerous across the country. There are national forests and national grasslands in every state except for 10, and even down into our territories. So El Yunque National Forest is in Puerto Rico. So national forests are one of the more well-known faces of public lands. Everybody knows national parks, right? They're kind of the big showpiece. They're showcase pieces of public lands.
Yep, yep.
Everybody can identify a picture of the Grand Canyon. And I test this with kids, right? We show them pictures of public lands and they all understand the Grand Canyon and they all understand Crater Lake. It's a lot harder for people to put identity on national forests. So we, as the Rogue River Siskiyou National Forest, those two forests were some of the very first forests that were created with the creation of the Forest Service. Rogue River National Forest was created in 1908. At that time, it was called the Crater National Forest. And then the Siskiyou National Forest was originally the Siskiyou Forest Reserve, and it was created in 1905. So they're both very old forests. They were combined in 2004 to become the Rogue River Siskiyou National Forest. So they went from being two separate forests, and now it's 1.8 million acres with the combination of the two. They're very different. They have very different feels. If you've spent time up near Prospect, right, that has a very different feel, and that's the original Rogue River National Forest. It has a very different feel than if you go over towards Cave Junction or even towards the coast. The landscapes are vastly different, and a huge part of that is because the Rogue River National Forest was established where the Cascades run through, and the Siskiyou National Forest, in large part, is the Klamath Siskiyou Mountains, and so they have different soils. They have a lot
huge,
of different
huge
plants.
Amounts of biodiversity where those
huge amounts
meet.
Of biodiversity. Yeah. Yes, and in fact, the forest as a whole is the most botanically biodiverse national forest in the country. National forests, we are surrounded by neighboring forests, right? We have Klamath National Forest to the south and Six Rivers National Forest as well. We have the Fremont Wainema to the east, and we have the Umpqua to the north. And so this national forest landscape is not only very large, but incredibly intertwined.
So as someone who's worked in the national forests, has worked in public lands, well, what are some challenges that anyone who's working in public lands would meet every day, just in maintenance, letting the public know about them, and in publicity as you're working as a publicity specialist, letting people know about it? What are some things that just some challenges people would face in the national forests who work in them to make sure they stay pristine and protected?
So challenges like all, everybody, right? Challenges ebb and flow and change all the time. And in the last 2 years, the challenges that public lands in general have seen are pretty consistent across the board. But for the Rogue River Siskiyou National Forest, Some of the bigger challenges we do face are things like increased dumping on public lands. We've all been out to public lands and seen piles of garbage or abandoned yes. camps or abandoned yes. vehicles. And I know that the perception tends to be that public lands employees see those things and choose to not do anything about them, right? Like somehow we walk by or we drive by and we're not trying to remedy the problem. But really what is going on is the problem has increased to the level that it is actually hard to keep up. mm-hmm. So we are seeing a lot more dumping on public lands and you know, that can be attributed to all sorts of things. And it has always been a problem in Southern Oregon. But there's definitely an increase in those sorts of activities on public lands. And the challenge for public lands employees is not only taking care of those, but also bearing the brunt of public judgment, right? Like when I'm out recreating on public lands and I see that stuff, I hope people would understand it. It hurts me to the core just as much as it would anyone else. Those are really special places often. And so the challenge is to try and distance myself from my personal, to understand it's okay where my personal and my professional opinions might mesh, but also to understand the reality of how hard it is for all of us to keep up with those sorts of things. So that is definitely one of the challenges we face. And of course, during the pandemic, and this is an amazing silver lining of the pandemic. There are a lot more people going outside, mm-hmm. right? It's better mm-hmm. for our mental health. It's safer to be away from people. It's just the use of public lands has skyrocketed in the last 2 years. And those of us who work in public lands see that as a really great thing. It means more people care, more people get to see and experience, and therefore they care about these places. But what we also see is people who might not have the information they need to be responsible or safe. So you get situations where people might not be prepared to go down that dirt, you know, that remote road in a snowstorm. Maybe they don't understand that Forest Service roads and BLM roads might not be plowed in the wintertime. They're usually not. So you wind up with situations where you have, you know, search and rescue scenarios, or you have people who are getting lost. And I don't know, you know, if the numbers of those instances have gone up. But I do know that a lot of effort is being paid to try and give people the information they need before those situations arise. And at some point after we talk about challenges, I would love to talk more about how people can be more prepared, because it really is on all of us, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So what are some things the Forest Service is doing to educate, because there are, in my experience, and again, it's kind of anecdotal, but there are a lot of people, you know, reaching out to me saying, I'm going outdoors for the first time. I just started getting the outdoors, going into the outdoors during the pandemic. What do I need to do? What do I need to bring? What are some things the Forest Service and you as a public publicity specialist with the Forest Service are doing to educate people who maybe never set foot in national forest, or maybe never set foot on a trail before, or haven't done so since they were, you know, in fourth grade when they hiked up Table Rock with their school class or whatever. What are some things the Forest Service is doing to help educate people about stewardship of public lands?
So the first thing I like to encourage people to do is, you know, as much as social media can be a challenge, or as much as the internet can be a challenge, we all know not everyone has access to either one of those, but most people do, or know somebody who does. So the first thing that I try, or we try to encourage people to do, is to really look at the place you're going online. Look at their website. Often those websites on public lands have things like links on where to get a map, or here are some tips on how to leave no trace, or links to current weather forecasts, right? We underestimate weather forecasts all the time. And that yes. is usually one yes. of the largest risks that we put ourselves in. I there's been a lot of emphasis on putting out graphics on how to dress appropriately for different kinds of weather, and, you know, taking the 10 essentials with you, making sure you have enough water and extra food and a map and the basic understanding of how to use all of these things that are designed to keep you comfortable and safe. And so there's a lot of outreach on social media. There's a lot of work with partner groups to help us do that. Often people don't feel comfortable talking to public lands folks for whatever reason. We definitely live in an area that is not always receptive to talking to government officials. That's just the reality, and that's fine. We have a lot of partner groups who help us communicate, whether it's, you know, groups who are helping to steward trails or motorized groups. We have all these groups who can help us get those messages out. And so a lot of times National Forests and Bureau of Land Management districts will go to those groups to help us. I do a lot of outreach on social media. That's a huge part of my job. And I try my hardest to post things that get people engaged, to get them to understand that there's a connection between the information I'm sharing and the place that they want to go. And so there are videos, you know, there's this whole slew of information. It's just figuring out where people might need to tap into it to make it work for them.
Absolutely. And you touched on something there, this concept of know before you go. And I know for a lot of people, they get in the car and they just set out. And, you know, I remember the first hike I ever went on, I was a teenager. It was up in Yosemite, and I had a little 16-ounce bottle of water, no pack. That was it. I ran out of that water very quickly and then drank water out of a stream, which wasn't very smart. Yeah. Doesn't feeling too well. Guardia. Yeah. It's a thing.
Guardia's real. Yeah.
It's real. You will get sick. But you talked about know before you go. What are some things that people need to know before they go? You said check the website. That's always important. Find out what the road conditions, weather conditions are. Particularly talk about the 10 essentials before you go check out. What are those? And what are some other things people need to know before they set out on foot or even on a four-wheeler out into the wilderness?
So let's start with the most important information that people can know, especially here. Here in this part of the world where we have five seasons, right? We have the standard four seasons, and then we have smoke and fire season.
Yes, yes, we do.
And it is really, really important for people to understand that weather, especially as you get up higher in elevation, and our elevations here can go from, you know, on the Rogue River Siskiyou National Forest, go from nearly sea level all the way up to nearly 10,000 feet at the top of Mount McLaughlin. So we run the gamut in terms of elevation, and the higher you go in elevation, the faster your weather can change. And so the first thing I like to tell people is to please, please, please go to the National Weather Service website, wherever you are, whether it's Medford or if you're going down into, you know, into a forest or a national park in California, look up the weather on the National Weather Service's page. They will tell you everything you need to know. They will tell you if there's predicted wind, if there's a red flag warning, if there is a thunderstorm, if there's rain, snow, all of those things. And that's really the first step to making sure that we're as safe and as prepared as we can be. The 10 essentials are really, you know, they seem so overwhelming when you look at them, because if you're new to hiking and you look at this list, you're like, oh my goodness, I could load a pack and it'll easily weigh 50 pounds. And how in the world am I supposed to go for a day hike with all of that? Right. And for somebody who's new to that, cost can be prohibitive.
Absolutely.
And access can be prohibitive. But really the 10 essentials for the most part are things that you're going to have in your house. Things that are relatively easy to get. So navigation, you should always have a map and not just your phone. Phones, while they have programs that have made them more reliable and make them function as a GPS, we've all heard stories about phones leading us astray or about them failing when we need them most. Yep.
All trails is wrong a lot of the time.
Yes. Yes. And I try and point people to Avenza if they're going to use a mapping tool. Because Avenza, you can actually get the map from the national forests or from the national parks often, or from the Bureau of Land Management. And that map becomes your background on your navigation. And it's actually very accurate. That being said, please carry a paper map, carry a compass, try and have a general idea of how to use them if you're going off trail, especially. It's really, really important. The map and the compass will not fail you if you know what, if you know how to use them, right? A headlamp is a pretty basic thing to obtain. You can probably get them used at places that sell secondhand sporting goods if you don't feel like going to a new store is something that's within your reach. A headlamp should be relatively easy to come by.
I got a $50 headlamp at REI garage sale that works great for $5.
There's, exactly. Yeah. Right. And you carry extra batteries just in case. And sun protection, right? And not just sunscreen, like carry a hat, get some sunglasses, try and keep your body in the best shape possible. I will tell you, having had sun, like heat exhaustion and too much heat exposure in my job, it is miserable. And I don't wish that on anyone. It wasn't, you know, medically serious, but it was really uncomfortable. And it made it very hard to drive home at the end of the day. I was tired. I was hot. So making sure you have adequate sun protection and even just basic first aid. Carry some Band-Aids. Any of us who have hiked with kids know stuff happens, right? Like,
yes, yes.
All the time. Carry a Band-Aid. It's not terribly hard. Although I have to tell you that the only time I've really had to utilize Band-Aids and felt like I was actually kind of not prepared was when I was riding with a grown person and they got injured. And I was like, oh my gosh, what do I do? So carry some basic first aid stuff. Carry a knife. Also very easy to get. Most of us have pocket knives. Just carry one. It's easy to get. It's easy to carry. A couple matches or a lighter. Something to start a fire in the event that you have to stay overnight somewhere. The shelter one kind of trips people up.
Yeah, I think they need to bring some big old Coleman tent or something.
Right. And really, like, just get one of those little aluminum type, like an emergency blanket, right? They're not very difficult to get. You can get a Coleman one, and that is all you need to do. Like, it's the size of your wallet, right?
Yeah, I have one I got. I don't even know where I got it. Just take a piece of paracord, tie it between two trees, stake it down. It literally fits in the palm of my hand.
Yep. Yeah. And they're affordable and just a good, easy security thing to have. Extra food. This one I live by. I tend to get really hungry and just snacky when I'm out. So I'll carry a couple extra bars, you know, or some fruit, just some things to keep you going. And again, none of this is meant to dissuade people from going out. It's to make sure that people understand that they are empowered to have a good time and to take care of themselves if something doesn't go according to plan, right? Extra water, like you had your story about 16 ounces, that is not enough.
Nope.
So take water and you can get, you know, little drops to throw in water if you need to. I do feel like with the extra water thing, the biggest misnomer is that if you don't have enough water, there will always be a stream that you can get water from.
Not true. Yeah. I have been on the backpacking trips where the map said there was a stream there and I'm hiking in Southern Oregon in August. That stream's not there. And my Sawyer, as much as I love my Sawyer filter, it wasn't going to do me any good. I should have been carrying an extra liter.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, we have a lot of seasonal streams, right? So unless you're down lower where there's perennial water, it's not a guarantee. So just make sure you've got enough water. And the last one for 10 essentials is extra clothes. And that one I cannot emphasize enough. Layers are important. And the proper layers are important. You know, you can have 10 layers of cotton, but if you get wet, you're still cold. So knowing what clothing is appropriate for where you're going, the time of year, and making sure that you have enough as those conditions change is really important.
And especially because I know in the summer here with thunderstorms, there's times you can look at the forecast and it says nothing and you're hiking up in a high elevation. All of a sudden, some thunderhead forms 20 minutes later, it's pouring. It only pours for 20 minutes. And if you don't have a raincoat, you're soaked for the rest of that hike. And always important, carry some sort of rain protection and extra clothes. You never know what's going to happen. There might be a blowdown. You might be stuck. And you're going to be happy you did.
Yes, indeed.
So with new hikers understanding the 10 essentials and what to bring, one thing as we're finishing up, and it's probably one of the most important things about public land is leave no trace. We see leavenotrace.org on Instagram all the time. People go hashtag leave no trace. What does that really mean? And how can we as hikers and outdoors persons and lovers of Mother Nature practice those things and advocate for them?
When I talk about the concepts and the principles of leave no trace, even with kids, I like to frame it as the most important part about leaving no trace is ensuring that the people who come after you have their own experience, right? It's not about me creating their experience for them. It's about making sure that everyone has their own personal experience to a place that is not affected by whoever was on that trail or in that campground or in that area the day before or 2 weeks before. It's really about making sure that we all get to have that connection on our own terms. And the Leave No Trace Center for Environmental Ethics has 7 principles, and I can run through them. Have you run through them on your program before?
I have never run through them on the program, and that is why you are here.
Excellent. I'm happy to talk about them. I should say that the Forest Service and other public lands agencies are partners with Leave No Trace Center for Environmental Ethics. And so we certainly always advocate for people to go to their website, which is lnt.org. You can learn more about all of the things that I'm about to share and more. Because leaving no trace is constantly evolving in some ways as technology and other things move forward. So the first principle is to plan ahead and prepare. We've kind of talked about that. Agencies call it know before you go. But it's really this concept that the more prepared you are, the less likely you are to leave your mark on a place. Everybody will benefit, including the landscape, if you're planning ahead and you're prepared for where you're going. The second one is to always travel and camp on durable surfaces where possible. And a durable surface just means that it's not going to really show that you were there when you leave. So when you're traveling on a durable surface, you're on a trail. And if you're on a trail and it's really wet, go through the mud. Don't step off to the side. That results in trails becoming wider. So it's really about understanding that as we move or we stay on a landscape, if we're doing that in a proper manner, nobody will know we were there before, except for possibly the footprints in the trail bed, right? You should always camp a minimum of 200 feet from water sources. And you can think of that in terms of adult steps. That's about 70 steps from a water source is where you'd want to pitch your tent if you're backpacking or camping somewhere. The third one is, this is a big one, please dispose of your waste properly.
Yes.
And this does include pet waste. Okay.
Yes.
Like
nothing bothers me more than people who pick up their dog waste and put it in the baggies and say, oh, I'm going to do it out and back. I'm going to pick it up on the way back. And they never do.
And they don't. Right. Yeah. The little teepees. This includes human waste as well. I don't know how many times I've pulled up to a trailhead and there's toilet paper, right? Or even uncovered human waste. I mean, it's all awful. Nobody wants to see any of it. And so the best thing to do, learn how to dig a proper cat hole, you know, carry a spade with you. Yep. Carry a trowel, bury it all. And if you are out with your dogs, they're wonderful. I have a dog. I love taking him hiking. I love it. We pick up his poop. And if we can't carry it out, we bury it. The big thing with pet waste is that it's got parasites in it, or it can. So not only is it really awful to see and smell as a human, it can make wildlife really sick. So best to take it out with you if you can. The fourth one is to leave what you find. This one we see come into play in places like Table Rocks, which is managed by the Bureau of Land Management, or other places where there are incredible wildflowers. I cannot tell you how my heart kind of sinks a little when I see people coming out of these places with bouquets of wildflowers.
Yeah.
And I know they're wonderful and I love them. I have a ridiculous love for plants, but the bottom line is that when you're picking things and removing them off the landscape, not only are you taking away the opportunity for somebody else to see those, but there are wildlife species that depend on those and plants that depend on those. So leave what you find. Minimizing your campfire impacts. This one feels like a no-brainer sometimes, but with a lot of new people out in the woods, I think it merits repeating. We're all friends of Smokey Bear. We all have a role to play in reducing human-caused fires. So the first thing to know, especially in summertime when you go out into public lands, is know what the current fire restrictions are where you're going. That is really easy to find either by visiting the National Forest website where you're going, or the National Park website, or here in Oregon, Oregon Department of Forestry also covers those things.
And there's always that big sign as you get into the forest boundary, Smokey Bear's on it. It has a little arrow, tells you what if you understand the fire restrictions, you know each level and you know, okay, it's in high, no burning.
Right. And there are also subtleties to fire restrictions. Sometimes we have areas in the forest where maybe you can have a campfire, but only if it's in a fire ring that the Forest Service built. Right? You can't just go out and build a fire wherever. It has to be in a specific place. And so knowing those current fire restrictions will keep you not only safe, but out of trouble. Because at the peak of fire season, there are people who are looking to make sure that important rule is being followed. And then if you do have a campfire, please know how to properly put it out. Make sure you have enough water to, you know, drown it, stir it, drown it again, check for heat before you go. I can't tell you how many campfires, abandoned campfires, our folks respond to every year. It is unbelievable. And when there are other things that they could be doing to respond to a smoking campfire, just kind of detracts from all the other work that can happen. So minimize your campfire impacts. Number six, respect wildlife. Leash your dogs. We all like to let our dogs off leash where we can. That being said, the understanding is they can harass wildlife. They can take off. Again, if they're leashed, you know where they're going to the bathroom. So clean up all of your food waste. This is a big one. We have a huge problem with bears on the Rogue River Siskiyou National Forest right now. You know, as drought continues and fire season kind of pushes them around, they tend to come down into places where food is easily accessible.
Mm-hmm. And my one bear encounter, I was hiking on the upper Rogue River Trail near Union Creek behind all those campsites, and a bear was up in a tree. The branch broke, bear fell down, it ran off, and I'm freaking out. I'm like reaching for my bear spray, like, oh no. It ran away very quickly, but it was like the funniest thing. It was up there at the campsites looking for food, scoping things out. Branch broke, boom, big puff of dirt. Startled me because it was like maybe 20 feet behind me. And yeah, they're looking for campsites or where the PCT hikers or backpackers are leaving food. They know where to go. They smell it from a mile away.
Oh yeah. They are creatures of habit too. And once they know, they keep coming back. And I, you know, it's a terrible phrase, but it's true. A fed bear is a dead bear. So once those bears are acclimated to some sort of bad behavior and they keep coming back, they become a threat to people. And so the most important thing we can do to protect ourselves and the bears is to properly store our food and to properly dispose of our garbage. REI has some great tips and products to help people properly store food if they're going for an overnight. They have tips on their website. Best thing to remember is bears are resourceful, so you have to outsmart them.
And for anyone who's listening, I have done an episode with Bear Vault, and they talk about bear safety and using the product last season. So I prefer using a bear cam because even bear hangs, bears can get to it. I've seen pictures and heard stories. I know bear cans are a pain when you're backpacking, but it's in my opinion, the best way to protect your food and anything that smells, even your toothpaste on the trail from bears. So,
yep. Don't keep any of that in your tent. That's the other thing. We've had bears break into tents, you know, when people were in there, and I can't imagine how terrifying that would be. So definitely respecting wildlife, and it definitely extends beyond bears, right? We don't feed the wildlife, and the Park Service has done an incredible job, in the last couple of years, trying to remind people how important it is to stay away from the buffalo, right? We've all seen the videos. It's part of respecting wildlife. Give them their space. Give them their space. Let them move through. Don't try and pet them.
Yeah, I know you went to Yellowstone to get that selfie with the buffalo, but they will kill you.
Right? Or you'll lose your pants. I think there was a story of a woman.
I've seen that.
So, not to laugh at her trauma, but let's be smart with animals. And the last principle, frankly, sums them all up, and it's to be considerate of other visitors. This would include, and this is a pet peeve of mine personally, not professionally, is being out on a trail or being outside and enjoying the sounds, and somebody is walking towards me with a speaker blaring music.
Those Bluetooth speakers, you know, will be the end of me.
It's just not kind. So, and that's part of being considerate of other visitors. If I wanted to listen to your music, I would ask for it, right? The other one that the Leave No Trace Center has been talking about, and I've listened to some of your other podcasts where you've talked about this too, is the notion of overly photographing and publishing sites on social media has resulted in not only more visitation, but really dangerous scenarios playing out where people are trying to get out into those ledges, those rock ledges, to get the best photo, and then they slip.
Yeah, I'm thinking like of Match Packs. So in the Smokies back east, they shut that thing down because of too many people getting Instagram photos and just destroying the vegetation in that area. They just had to shut it down because too many people were sharing, being overshared.
Right. You see it when they have super blooms down south, where you have people venturing off the trails and then laying in the flowers and taking photos, and all of a sudden the flowers are all trampled. I can't say that I've seen a lot of that here, but I think it bears noting that when we put photos out for people to see places, it means they're going to possibly go there. And so we have to really consider the implications of that. Another one that I think about with consideration towards others is rock cairns, which can either be a helpful tool and really valuable. If you're out in the wilderness and there are no trail signs, you'll often see a cairn marking where the trail is. That's important. Let's leave that. That is there for a reason. And then you have those who are building rock cairns wherever they go because it's fun. Mm-hmm. And that's affecting somebody else's experience. And so before you make a decision to build a sculpture out of rocks that doesn't serve a real purpose, really consider whether that is necessary for somebody else to enjoy that place.
And nothing frustrates me more when I'm even at Lithia Park in Ashland, and you see the cairns there, and it's like that messes with the habitat of the wildlife in that creek that depend on that creek and depend on the rocks. And it's very frustrating. And plus there's Lithia Park has very well marked trails. We don't need cairns.
Right. You're not going to get lost, right? Just go downhill. and they are well marked. And you brought up a really great point too, that the rocks are wildlife. There was actually a forest in the east in the National Forest System that was having a real issue with people moving rocks around in the creek beds and making, you know, like little swimming holes, you know, by building rock dams. And it turns out that there were salamanders that were incredibly dependent on that very fragile ecosystem. And so this national forest actually had to take the time to figure out how to still allow people in, but to educate them on the importance of leaving the rocks.
And that takes resources. I think of the top of Grizzly Peak out here. There was someone had made a labyrinth type thing, and it looked beautiful, no doubt, but it had to be removed because it was disrupting the ecosystem. And that's time and energy and money that could be spent elsewhere to help preserve public lands that now have to be lifting these rocks up, trying to fix the soil and redistribute those to where they go. It's unfortunate. We know everybody loves art, especially in here in Ashland. We get it. But at the same time, it's not natural. It doesn't happen naturally. So we shouldn't be doing it.
Exactly. I think reframing this concept of what is art and what is beautiful, perhaps it helps to think of it as if you look a little closer and you dig a little deeper mentally into these landscapes around you, you can start seeing all the patterns and the beauty that exist without your help. And there's some real magic to that. And I really encourage people to just, you know, look a little closer before you build that rock sculpture. Does nature really need your help being incredible?
Absolutely.
The last thing to be considerate, and this is also very important. You talked about Lithia Park and the Ashland watershed, especially these areas that see a lot more people on a day-to-day basis. A lot of them are multi-use, right? So you can mountain bike, you can hike, you can run, you can ride a horse. When we talk about all these places with all these people doing different things, it's really important to know how to be considerate of other trail users and to know who yields to who, and just all the etiquette that goes along with that. And those who might be new to recreating outdoors, I think of it as, you know, you've seen the triangle probably at a trailhead, but just remember that mountain bikes yield to hikers and everybody yields to people on horses. And that's really important. It helps everybody feel safer outside and it helps everyone have an enjoyable experience. And if somebody is coming downhill and somebody is going uphill, the uphill person actually has the right of way.
Yeah, everybody thinks it's the opposite. It's really hard to get your momentum going back when you're shooting up there.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, think of driving a car, right? It's the same rule.
Mm-hmm. So, Shanice, with all that said, you've lived in this wonderful region of the country for so long. Ultimately, how has the outdoors and public lands changed you?
Oh, man. I think I can't imagine what my day-to-day would be like without not just public lands, but the outdoors in general. I have raised my kid to appreciate public lands and knowing that public lands stewardship is ever evolving, so is its understanding, right? So as I move further into my career and our conversations in this country focus more on diversity, equity, and inclusion and the history of public lands, I think the most valuable way that it's changed me is understanding that everyone's relationship to these places is different. Everyone's relationship to the history of these places is different. And I think at the end of it all, it's made me a much more well-rounded and compassionate person. I grew up, A, not understanding the Forest Service or caring, but also B, I grew up in an area that had, still has, a lot of tensions surrounding public lands between the history of public lands and the tribal peoples of the Klamath Basin. And I think as I've gotten older and worked in these places and talked with more people, my understanding of why those voices are equally, if not more important than the status quo that I grew up with, I think that has been the greatest gift. And then recreating on them, of course, is a whole different, that's a whole separate component that just brings my spirit so much joy. And I love hearing stories about people like yourself who found this awakening in these places. I think that that is the magic of nature and being outside.
It can take a city kid like me from LA and Vegas and turn him into a piker trash outdoorsy person who makes TikToks. What do you do? Denise, thank you so much for coming on and sharing your story and telling us about public lands and the National Forest. If someone wanted to learn more about public lands, Leave No Trace of the National Forest, what are some resources they could go find on the internet?
So the Rogue River Siskiyou National Forest is on Facebook. You can look us up as U.S. Forest Service, Rogue River Siskiyou National Forest. You can also follow us on Twitter, same name. And then I really encourage people to look at the websites of national forests in your area. Here it is. It should come up if you Google Rogue River Siskiyou National Forest. It should come up as one of your top searches. For Leave No Trace, please, please, please go to lnt.org. And they have all sorts of things, including online trainings that you can do for yourself or even with your kids. They've done a ton of research. And the other resources that are incredibly valuable, especially here locally, would be your local trail groups. The ones that we tend to talk about a lot, and I'll totally name drop here, we've got the Pacific Crest Trail Association. We have the Siskiyou Mountain Club for those who prefer hiking in wilderness areas. That's their focus. We have the Ashland Woodlands and Trails Association here in Ashland. We have the Southern Oregon Trail Association. They cover a lot of things out in the Illinois Valley. And then we have the Siskiyou Uplands Trail Association, which does a lot of work out in the Applegate. And all of those groups are really great for resources for those who want to get out and experience these places.
And wherever you're at in the country, there are resources and trail associations where you're at who maintain those trails, because those trails don't get maintained by themselves. People work on them. There's trail maintenance crews, and there's associations and foundations that do that, whether you live by the PCT or the CDT or the Arizona Trail or the Appalachian Trail. Get connected with one of them. Amazing.
Absolutely. And they're always looking for volunteers.
Yes.
If you find yourself wanting to give back to public lands and to these places, there is no better way than to try and volunteer a few hours of your time.
If you want to hear about what you do on a trail crew, a few episodes ago last season, we had Oregon Trail Keepers on the show, and they talked about what trail keepers do. So, Denise, thank you so much for coming on the Hiker Podcast and sharing your love and passion for the outdoors and public lands.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much, Shamise, for coming on the show. In the description of this episode, I'm putting as much information and links as the description will allow me. And this week, sometime, I will make a link with all that information on hikerpodcast.com and graphics and everything. I think so much of this information is important, especially if you're a new hiker. I know I have so many new hikers listening to this show. Thank you for listening. Thank you for taking the time and listen all the way through. And once again, Shamise, thank you so much for coming on the show and being amazing. I'm blown away. I say that every episode, because every week I'm just more and more blown away by all the new listeners that are out there. If you want to know what's going on with me, follow me at Andy Films and Hikes, or you can follow the Hiker Podcast at Hiker Podcast. Go to hikerpodcast.com for all of our links, Patreon support, check out who our sponsors are, all that fun stuff. And as we're getting out of the year, we're getting ready for spring. I would just encourage you all to take the time to do what Shimi said and learn about the places you're hiking. Know before you go. And really be prepared. Prepare yourself for this spring and summer when you go out camping and hiking, and learn as much as you can. We live in some amazing places, whether it's the Sonoran Desert, or it's the Great Smoky Mountains, or it's Banff National Park in Canada, or anywhere else in the world. To experience public lands and hike on them is an amazing privilege. So learn everything you can. Find links, all that fun stuff. And go outside, enjoy public lands, whether it's a park, whether it's national park, national forest. Enjoy the benefits of public lands. With that, guys, don't forget to like, follow, and subscribe. No, not like, follow, and subscribe. But that segues into make sure you check out my YouTube channel, Andy Neal Plus Size Hiker. A lot of great information there. Link for that is in the description of this episode. And with that, thank you for listening to this week's episode of the Hiker Podcast. Mm-hmm.